Well, it was good to hear that one developing country in the Americas, El Salvador, might be emerging from chronic troubles and violence. Another, Colombia, is most definitely not, according to the Swedish journalist Magnus Linden, who'll join us now. A few years back, he set out to write a book about a country he's fallen in love with. The natural beauty, the cultural richness, the people. He didn't want to write about drugs and violence, two words synonymous with Colombia, but he found it impossible to avoid, and he had to reorientate his focus to exploring why the business of drugs had so terribly but comprehensively corrupted Colombian society. It's not just years, decades of endemic violence that Helen Clark referred to earlier as being so destructive to communities, but something far deeper that he manages to describe well in his rich work, Cocaine, a book on those who made it. No story, I think it's Cocaine Up, pardon me, no story exemplifies the pervasive moral decline, the loss of hope, more than that of the Falsos Positivos, where nearly 2,000 destitute young men were taken away over the years on false promises of work, only to end up dead. Then they were dressed up in FARC guerrilla outfits to claim better success statistics for the army, with equivalent benefits for military officers. Now, this scandal broke 5 years ago in Colombia, and it's still reverberating, as is the death of the notorious drug lord Pablo Escobar. But the question remains, who can really durably circuit break this diabolical plight for average Colombians? Well, Magnus Linton is trying by painstakingly attempting to research and then assemble both the facts and the deeper currents of this story. And he's left his homes in Bogota and Stockholm to join us. A big welcome to you to Saturday Extra, Magnus.
Thank you.
In fact, you say in your book, in its own way, this book is a bit of a failure because I ended up writing about the precedence of cocaine. You says it takes precedence over everything and it links most things together. Did you find people or places who just weren't caught up in the process of, and violence of the drug?
Yeah, of course. If you go to Colombia, you can see whatever you want to see. So you can find areas, you can find regions, you can find people that superficially are not affected or not involved in this business. But as soon as you start to dig a little deeper to any story about Colombia, then you end up in drug trafficking, drug production, drug criminality.
Or someone having lost somebody as a result of some vendetta or raid or shootout. That's what your point, I think.
Absolutely. But not just that. I mean, if you talk to anyone in Colombia, everyone has a friend or a family member that got murdered. But it also that the drug industry is affecting the entire society in such a deep way. So you cannot get around it if you want to write a political story about this country.
Well, I found it quite astounding how even the tourist trade had accommodated to the drug scene, not just the Pablo Escobar tours that they do, but soundproof bunkers built within backpackers' hostels so that people during their sort of chatty phase coming off cocaine can congregate there and not wake up other guests. How does this happen?
Well, it's about cocaine tourism, which is a really, really big thing in Latin America today. You have young people, backpackers, and other tourists just coming to places like Medellin to do drugs. Because what's new in tourism, global tourism, is that you can, if you come from the rich part of the world, you can go to the poor areas that have become sort of recreational areas for things you're not allowed to do or things you cannot do at home because you can't afford it. And you can get, in this case, a lot of drugs for no money.
So why Colombia? Why not elsewhere? It could have been elsewhere, you make the point. Why did Colombia become the cocaine capital of the world?
Mainly because of two things, poverty and conflict. In order to become a very efficient drug-producing nation, you have to have big, poor areas, people that are prepared to jump into any kind of job in this business because they have nothing else to do, or at least nothing that gives them money. And you need also a territory that where the state is not controlling the entire territory. So if you see it, when it comes to heroin, for instance, 90% of the heroin consumed in the world is produced in Afghanistan, right? Mm. And 60% of the cocaine used in the world is produced in Colombia. Those two countries, what they have in common is that they are conflict areas, right? And in the case of Colombia, you have, in the conflict, you have the parts fighting. They need to finance their war, and they don't have any moral considerations of how to get their money, right? So that's, I think poverty and conflict is the main answer. But there are others.
And look, you do go into that. But I like the way you try to stand back and look at broader issues. It was also a rural elite and a desperately poor, this goes back to your poverty, but within that you had sort of pre-existing social structures that were inherited, weren't they, that contributed to this phenomenon you're talking about?
Colombia is a feudal system, has been so for long. So you have a rural aristocracy that is really important to this story. And you have a war that has been going on for almost 50 years now. So there was a guerrilla movement that when the Berlin Wall fell, then they lost their support from the Soviet Union. And then the guerrilla, the leftist guerrilla, started to produce cocaine.
FARC, wasn't it?
Yeah, FARC, to get the resources for the war. And in order to defend themselves from the guerrillas, the old elite formed their own, since the state wasn't really present, they formed their own paramilitary groups.
Who killed Escobar, didn't they?
They were part in that because they were his enemies. But these right-wing death squads are also financed by cocaine money. So you have two parts, and they're both financed on this in the same way.
A true war, just not the way we think about it. And in fact, the business of killing has become perfected, including, and listeners will think I'm joking here, a school to train young men. Tell us about that.
That was during the Pablo Escobar era. And at that time, in a city, the city of Medellin, which is not even a big city, 3,000 kids a year were killed. It's an incredible amount of young people that were killed during those years. And in order to just make this more professional, a school was founded in just educating kids in how to kill other people.
How to ride a motorcycle at top speed while firing a machine gun at a target with absolute precision.
Exactly.
My guest is Magnus Linton. He's written a really remarkable book called Cocaina, a book on who made it. It's about Colombia and the horrors of living there if you're trying to live a decent life. I might actually hop over to that right now because you go very deep trying to describe these events. You write that Colombians have no real moral compass about how they live anymore, about life. And you put that down to the endemic violence that they see around them. And the capricious change, if somebody rises up to look like a beacon of hope, they're killed. They're just as sure as anything, they're killed. And that this is really permeating all levels of society.
Yeah, that's the story of Colombia, is that every movement, social movement, liberal progressive party or a trade union or some kind of political mobilization for a better Colombia, the leaders of those organizations, being parties or trade movements or whatever, have been killed by the old elite in the country. And that has created kind of a desperate situation for politics in this country. And that also plays an important role in why the situation is as it is today.
What about the role of the church? I mean, this would have traditionally been a very strong bulwark of the Catholic Church, I assume. Do they not send out messages about the how wrong this is?
Oh, yeah. The church plays a very conservative role in the country and has been part of chasing down and also killing liberals or people that have been fighting for secularization of the country. But on the other hand, you have a very progressive part of the church too, that has been involved in trying to make the world understand how bad the situation is for human rights and things like that in the country.
So tell us about the role of Escobar. He was a big fish in the drug scene, indeed, though his death didn't seem to do anything to slow down production. I mean, there has been a concentrated effort, hasn't there, on stopping the first step of making cocaine, that is targeting the farmers. But then you make the point that's resulting in a whole set of other problems, including a refugee problem within Colombia and on its borders. But is it stopping people from growing the cocoa plant?
No, the problem with the war on drugs in Colombia is that they have used this method of aerial spraying. So while the production was concentrated in the beginning to some few provinces, when they started the aerial spraying, that made farmers just run around the country. So today you have a situation where coca is grown all over the country, and with coca comes violence. Mm. So instead of having the problem in a few provinces, today it's just all over.
And the role of Escobar himself, before we leave him behind, I mean, just his very story is a sort of an exemplifies what's happened in a way, isn't it, to Colombia in the last 40 years, 30, 40 years?
He plays a very important role in the foundation of modern Colombia. And he was a populist. He was trying to become a left-wing politician. Mm. And he was quite successful in that. And then he started to use all his drug money to convince people that he was a fantastic person. So he was...
So he got into demagoguery virtually, didn't he?
Incredibly so. And then he completely lost it because he started to kill off all his enemies, and that was during the 80s. So he was basically... He is a horrible figure in the Colombian history.
But the point is, he also grew up during a time of great violence, didn't he? During, you say, the sort of pivotal time, the assassination of an up-and-coming presidential hopeful, Jorge Gaitán, in 1948, and that in a sense you see that as the time when there was this unleashing of an ongoing trauma that is really never stopped.
In 1948, that's when modern Colombia, the violent modern Colombia, comes into being for sure.
So whenever you really asked people to try to extract themselves out of all of these terrible statistics and this sense of terrible drift, and it like a fatalism about drifting down, the one thing they said to you is, there's only one real answer, it's to legalise drugs. Politically, that's impossible. Why?
Well, the legalisation debate in the world is a bit naive because it's not really on the agenda. If you want to legalise drugs in one country, you can't do that because all this is regulated on a UN level. In that sense, it's politically impossible. But another guy, professor that I'm interviewing, he says, what has to be legalized is not drugs, it is Colombia.
Yes, it's a marvelous quote.
And I think he's right there because the problem is not really cocaine as such in this case. The problem is that Colombia is a country that for decades now, where not all Colombians, but many Colombians are just used to live outside
legal system. Outside a system of laws.
Exactly. But it's not just people, also the institutions. If you look at the military in Colombia, for instance, you can find incredible human rights abuses within the army, within the police force. And as long as the country doesn't wake up and get rid of that and is able to clean their institutions, this kind of illegal activity will continue.
You do also say, finally, that it brings together a range of terrible things. It's the relationship between rich and poor continents in years to come, the United States' need to find a new menace in the post-Soviet era, it's the resurgence of populism in Latin America. This is what was interesting. Postmodern society's desperate effort to fill the existential gap left by the death of God, and so on. So look, do you draw anything positive out of this investigation of a country that you actually love?
I'm a journalist. I'm not a politician. I'm not a missionary. So I have my intention was never to come up with the great answer how to solve all these problems without the quite obvious answer that I've already said, what has to be legalized is not necessarily drugs, but Colombia.
And actually, what do you mean by that? Because, I mean, you can't legalize a country. It's a country.
A country is a country. But the problem is that if you have a country that is so, like, where the poverty is so endemic, combined with the situation of a 50-year-old conflict, and a rural elite that is used to solve their problems with arms, which is the case in Colombia. In that situation, you can never get rid of a problem like this. So that's where you have to start with those three problems. And I think there are some positive signs. The situation is not that desperate. Right now, there are peace negotiations between the guerrillas and the government. I think that's good. If that can end in some kind of
truce,
that would be one step.
Well, Magnus Linton, you've done certainly a terrific job in alerting us all to this. I hope that there are some solutions available. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Magnus Linton, a Swedish journalist who has written Cocaina, a book on those who make it. It's published by Scribe. And what we've talked about is only part of what Magnus has observed. So if you'd like to hear more, tune in to RN's Big Ideas next Monday night from 8 p.m. when Magnus will be their guest.